I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There were high-level meetings between American and European officials on Sunday to try to jumpstart the stalled Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. This flurry of activity was in response to a decision made by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to seek membership and recognition at the United Nations this week. The Obama administration is in the awkward position of favoring statehood for the Palestinians while promising to veto the statehood vote at the U.S. This could create more problems for the U.S. in the Middle East that has been transformed by the Arab Spring. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to discuss the implications of a U.N. vote and the prospects for a meaningful peace process. And we have two guests. Khalid El-Ghindi is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He served with the Negotiation Support Unit in Ramallah as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and was a key participant in negotiations launched at Annapolis a couple of years ago. And Khalid El-Ghindi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is David Makovsky. He's a fellow and director of the Project on Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute. His most recent work includes the Interactive Map Project, Imagining the Border, Options for Resolving the Israeli-Palestinian Territorial Issue. He's also co-author with Dennis Ross of the 2009 book called Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. And David Makovsky, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be with you.
Khalid, let me begin with you. With a U.N. vote, would that give Palestinians something closer to statehood than they have gotten under negotiations?
Well, it wouldn't give them statehood on the ground, but it would give them a sense, I think it would change the political dynamic between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that's the ultimate goal. At the same time, I think it's also a way for the Palestinian leadership to save the two-state solution, even the option of a two-state solution, which is rapidly being eroded on the ground. And in that sense, it's actually odd that the United States and Israel would not support it.
You're saying that this would actually jumpstart or get people back to the table?
Not necessarily back to the table, because I think this is above everything else, a real sign of Palestinian discontent and frustration with the way the peace process, such as it is, has been conducted over the past several years. But what it is designed to do, I think, is to change the dynamic between the two parties, to level the playing field a little bit more so that the process can actually bear fruit rather than simply institutionalize Palestinian weakness.
And I do want to get to you, David Makovsky, but one more question to you, Khalid El-Ghindi, which is, when you talk about changing the dynamic, what do you mean by that?
Well, to create a more level playing field between the two parties, we all know that Israel has a great deal of leverage over the Palestinians. They're the occupying power. They can move unilaterally, and they often do. They create facts on the ground, settlements, checkpoints, the situation, the closure of Gaza. They can do all of these things unilaterally to pressure Palestinians. And this is a way for Palestinians to even the playing field just a little bit more. They'll never be equal parties at the negotiating table, but it's designed to give Palestinians access to international forums, to raise their stature, to increase their domestic political standing, which has been on the decline really for the past decade, almost uninterrupted decline. And so in that sense, they're trying to improve their standing vis-a-vis their own people, and with regard to Israel.
To you, David Makovsky, why do you think Mahmoud Abbas is seeking recognition and statehood at the UN this week?
I think part of it is a search for legacy. He has announced that he does not want to run again. He would like to come to say that he brought his people to this sort of international forum. Yes, there's probably frustration with negotiations, as Khalid said, but there's also an element of the Arab Spring, a belief that he has to search for some sort of master stroke that would capture the imagination of Palestinians after he lost his patron, which has been Hosni Mubarak. So I think that is part of the issue with him.
Do you think it would hurt the peace process such as it is?
I do, because, look, if it was just symbolic, you know, I think, you know, whatever you could do to help Abbas would be there would be value to it. But, you know, the devil here could be in the details. That's why there's importance of having an alternative resolution that would maybe maintain some of the symbolisms of upgrading Palestinian status rather than dealing with the with what we think are the core elements right now, which is something that would, what Khaled said, they can go to international agencies. I mean, I think that's the International Criminal Court he might be alluding to, where the PA Justice Minister, when in January 2009, asked for jurisdiction. We would be basically importing this conflict into a courtroom, because they would then say that Israeli officials could be charged as war criminals. The goal is to solve this tragedy, bring dignity to both sides. You could do that around a negotiating table, but if you start hauling people in front of court, this isn't exactly the way to kind of win friends, influence people. I think that we got to keep the focus, you know, like a laser beam on the negotiations themselves. Another element in the resolution, as we understand it, is a demarcation of borders that would, you know, might make negotiations harder. If anything over the border of the 67 war was basically now the state of Palestine, what negotiator is going to want to agree on some of the compromises that President Obama spoke of, which is land swaps, that is offsetting territory, territorial exchange. This, we need to be creative. We got to enable maximum creativity. So I think this is something that we need to think about. And I would just hope that there would be an alternative resolution that Tony Blair and I think Lady Ashton of the European Union are working on to find a way that would give some symbolic, you know, gesture to Abbas, but would also turbocharge these talks that have been stalled and not cross any of these lines that Israel sees as you know, as very inimical to them. So well, I think we've got to look for a balance here.
Well, let me go back to you, Khaled Al-Ghindi. Do you think that, bottom line, Mahmoud Abbas is interested in war crimes trials and using the UN to get to that?
I think there are a lot of Palestinians who would like to pursue that route. I don't think Mahmoud Abbas is one of them. I think above all else, the ability to have access to international forums like the ICC is more than anything a deterrent. And I think that's what the Palestinians are going for. Right now, Israel has a free hand militarily, politically, construction-wise on the settlements, in security terms. It can do as it pleases with or without negotiations. What Mahmoud Abbas is trying to do is, at least in terms of a future war, if I have access to the ICC, that might be a deterrent. That could deter future military campaigns. I don't think he intends, and I can't speak for him, but I don't believe that he intends to bring Israelis before to push for their prosecution for past crimes. I think there are some Palestinians who do want to do that, but I don't think Mahmoud Abbas is one of them, because it's not compatible with his goal of a negotiated settlement. You can't negotiate with people that you're trying to prosecute for war crimes. And I think it's not about those things. Israel can pursue any number of means politically. It has allies in Washington. It has all kinds of levers, and Palestinians can have none. And what this is trying to do is sort of violate these rules of a peace process that almost preconditions the process on Palestinians being weak and divided and politically dysfunctional, and having no leverage. And so this is an attempt to restore some balance in order to have a fruitful process.
Khaled, what though, when Mahmoud Abbas makes his actual bid, if that happens this week, and it's looking like it will, what would that state look like? Would it include Gaza? I mean, what would this Palestinian state look like?
Well, I think it would look, it would look like what it would look like ordinarily. Even, you know, it would look very much like what David's maps have indicated. I don't think that there's any change in terms of what a Palestinian state would look like. It would still be based on the 1967 lines. They would still negotiate land swaps. They would still negotiate the future of holy sites in Jerusalem, and they would still have to deal with security issues and how to make those arrangements between the two states, as well as a slew of other issues. So it doesn't change the way a Palestinian state looks, and certainly Gaza would be an integral part of any Palestinian state. So this is just a way, this is a way to achieve the same goal through different means, because what the United States is asking the Palestinians to do is return to a failed status quo. You know, we've been having these negotiations for 2 decades now, and in the past 2 years, the administration has not really come up with any new ideas to actually move this process forward. And so what the Americans are offering is come back to the way things were, i.e. failure, and that just doesn't seem like much of an incentive.
Hold on 1 second, Kali, because I want to give David Minkowski a chance to respond to that. Do you see and understand, David, the frustration among Palestinians on this issue?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, we don't have to get into the recrimination of how we got here. Everyone's got their own narrative on that. But you can be assured that, you know, the Israelis have their narrative just as, you know, the Palestinians have theirs. Let me just say this. I think the way out of this that would avoid the, you know, Khalid's fears of, oh, they just want to talk in order to talk and it's not about a solution, is basically to take the Obama speeches of May, which I think privately Prime Minister Netanyahu has come to agree would be what we would call terms of reference, you know, the basis, the framework for any negotiations. That would ensure that these talks are not meandering, because he says, you know, it would be based on these land exchanges. And I think that's a substantive way forward. That would give these talks some meaning, direction, you know, and a structure. I think that is really crucial. And to me, that's the way forward. The theater of the UN, you know, could be just theater, or it could have some of these, what Israel would consider poison pill elements. You know, Abbas doesn't have to say, I want to take Israel tomorrow to the ICC, but someone else can. There's just no trust there between the parties themselves. I think the key is to use the Obama speeches. I think that's the one way out of this that would be substantive. It would address Khalid's concerns that these talks are just meandering, and it would address the Israel's concerns that there would not be somehow some sort of UN template that would not allow this sort of creativity at the table. I think
David, we
should focus on Obama. I think that's the way forward.
Well, in fact, I'll pick up on that after that after this very short break, and that is David Minkowski with the Washington Institute. Khalid El-Gindi is also with us from the Brookings Saban Center for Middle East Policy, talking about Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's bid expected this week, seeking statehood for the Palestinian people. We'll be right back.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia launches a new season with Carmen, running in 5 performances September 30th through October 14th at the Academy of Music. This classic production features Renat Shahan in the title role, with an opening night simulcast live on Independence Mall. Information on Carmen at operaphila.org or 215-893-1018. The Opera Company of Philadelphia is proud to support WHYY.
Hi, Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden here, inviting you to join us for our next web chat, where we'll cover garlic planting, fun with pansies and fall greens, and all the great parts of the second season of gardening. The web chat takes place live Wednesday, September 21st at noon at whyy.org/garden.
Rowan University supports WHYY. Rowan's Rohrer College of Business and the College of Engineering offer graduate programs for those interested in furthering their education and advancing their career. An open house will be held on Wednesday, September 21st for the MBA, Master of Engineering Management, and other graduate programs in business and engineering. More information about the open house and how to register can be found at rowanu.com/openhouse. or 856-256-4747.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Looks like Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is going to go to the UN later this week to make a bid for statehood status. We're talking about the options and implications of this upcoming vote and what, if anything, can be done to revive talks about a two-state solution. And again, Khaled Al-Gindi, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy, is with us, joining us from their studios. And joining us by telephone is David Makovsky, fellow and director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute. And we want to hear from you. What do you think would lead to a two-state solution? What can be done to get this conflict resolved? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. David, let me go back to you. And you said that in order to make progress on this issue, the negotiators, people have to go back to Obama's speeches. What, though, has prevented, he's made several speeches about the Middle East. What has prevented progress on those speeches?
Well, look, he gave two speeches. One was May 19th and the second was May 22nd. And those speeches basically put forward, and here I would respectfully disagree with Khaled, who said the U.S. has put forward nothing new. Indeed, this was a huge change in American policy, which basically said, the 367 line would be kind of a baseline, but clearly there would be creativity so that whatever Israel would annex in terms of settlements largely adjacent to the old boundary would be offset by Israeli gains on the other side. Now, I'm somewhat partial to that because, as Khaled mentioned, I've done these maps, which the New York Times has now put online, looking at what would be scenarios based on these maps. On these ideas, right, of land swaps. So I think that this was the effort of the administration. They tried it at a July 11th meeting of the what's called the quartet, not a barbershop singing group, but a diplomatic contract group, U.S., European Union, Russia, the United Nations, and trying to see, well, can we just jumpstart these talks and give people a sense of that this is going to be based on something. And that's, you know, then the Europeans had their reservation, and Tony Blair has been working this as the quartet envoy. So there's a hope here that this week, whatever, if they come up with an alternative resolution, these ideas will also be packaged together, and that would say, here, we want to resume the talks. It's not going to be talking for talking. There's going to be a framework now to these discussions, and I think that would at least give people some hope that this has a common basis to move forward and would address some of Khaled's concerns.
Does that address some of your concerns, Khaled?
Well, more importantly, I don't think it really addresses the Palestinian concerns and much of the international community, including Europe and others who have been unhappy with the way Americans have led this process. But I just want to focus on this suggestion that David made about focusing on Obama. Let's focus on Obama. What do we have to look forward to? The fact of the matter is that Obama has less room to maneuver in this next year, assuming the negotiations were to start now. Obama has less room to maneuver than he has over the past 3 years because we're now entering an election cycle in this country. And there are a host of other issues that take precedent over foreign policy issues, but also there are important political constituencies and many in Congress who are opposed to the administration's even pushing for a two-state solution or pushing Israel to do what is required for a two-state solution. And we see that more and more in the discourse by Democrats and Republicans who are unhappy with the White House for what they see as undue pressure on Israel. So if we're going to move towards a credible process, how can Obama or his envoys or his administration have any real room to maneuver? I don't see that happening. And I think Palestinians are well aware of the American political calendar and the considerations that entail. We're going to see a lot of pro-Israel pandering, quite frankly, in this coming year. And that's not an environment conducive towards the United States playing a role of an even-handed broker.
David, let me go back to you. Do you think there is pressure that the Obama administration can put on Israel and its leadership to move forward on some of these negotiations?
Look, I disagree with the premise. I mean, I think that, for decades, or whatever, the Palestinians wanted the United States to do what President Obama did. Now that he's done it, it's suddenly, not so important, and now how can he twist Israel's arm now? I think the key here is to say, here, if this is the baseline of 67-plus land swaps, then that's a huge, huge historical threshold being crossed. And then I think really it's incumbent also on the Palestinians that they cross an equally weighty historical threshold. Let me explain this simply. Let me explain this very simply, if I can, ma'am, which is this, that each side has a narrative of these talks. And there's gut fears on each side. For the Palestinian, their fear is that it's about the land and about the settlements, and if we don't act soon, there's no hope for a two-state solution. And I understand their narrative, and that's why I worked on these maps. I took it seriously. But you should know that there's a separate narrative of the Israeli side, and they believe it has nothing to do with land. They gave up land in Gaza and Lebanon, and they got 12,000 rockets. In their view, the land is not the problem. Land would make Israel more, should make Israel more secure, not more vulnerable. Their view is they're about acceptance, that Israel's not accepted in the region. And because Hamas doesn't accept Israel the size of a telephone booth in Tel Aviv. So, therefore, it seems to me both sides have to cross a historical watershed because they have to respond to the gut fears of their people. The Palestinians, you've got to deal with the land. Israel, you've got to cross the threshold on land. And you Palestinians, it's got to be respond to the Israeli narrative that's about acceptance in the region, and that means accepting Israel as a Jewish state, of course, with equal rights for all citizens. I think that both sides have to cross that historical threshold together. If not, neither side crosses.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Khaled Al-Ghindi, I'll put to you the question that David raises, and this is the narrative from the Israeli perspective. Is Israel safe in its region? And by that I mean, is there acceptance for a Jewish state within the Middle East?
I think there's two separate issues. There's the acceptance as quote unquote of Israel as quote unquote a Jewish state, which is a new condition that has been added by the Netanyahu government in recent years that did not exist at the beginning of the peace process 20 years ago or during the Oslo years. It certainly wasn't a requirement for Israel to sign a peace treaty with Jordan and with Egypt. You have an Arab League initiative put forward that Israel hasn't really responded to, except to say, there's something there that might look nice. You have a proposal by all 22 Arab states to accept Israel into the region, provided that a Palestinian state is created based on the 1967 lines, that there would be an equitable and agreed resolution to the refugee issue, all of the essentially the same terms of reference to the peace process that anyone who's watched this issue has understood, and so there is, I think, the potential for acceptance for Israel, but from the Arab point of view, it's a quid pro quo. It's Israel will be accepted into the region when it complies with international law and when it complies with the obligations of requirements for an acceptable two-state solution, not any old Palestinian state, but an acceptable two-state solution. And then it will be accepted into the region.
Well, let me just stop you there. But is it a linguistic problem, the idea of a Jewish state, or the idea of statehood?
No, of course, the PLO has recognized Israel as a state since 1988, and again during the Oslo exchange of letters, letters of recognition between the PLO and Israel. There's no question of PLO recognition of Israel as a state. From the Palestinian point of view, it's up to Israel to determine its character. It's a Jewish state, it's a democratic state, it's a socialist state, it's a republic, it's not a republic, it's something else. Those are things that are up to Israel. States don't recognize each other on the basis of their character. And there's also a number of implications of doing that. It seems clear from what we've heard from Israeli leaders, they're trying to preempt by using the Jewish state recognition issue. They're trying to preempt certain issues like the Palestinian refugee issue. And at the end of the day, the Palestinians can't be expected to adopt the Zionist narrative of this is the homeland of the Jewish people. That essentially negates their historical narrative. And regardless of, I'm sure David will disagree, but at the end of the day, this is a non-issue. This is a manufactured issue about recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. It's unprecedented, as far as I know, in international relations. States don't recognize each other on the basis of their character.
Well,
they recognize each other legally and politically.
And I do want to give there's so many issues here, and I don't want to get too bogged down, but I also know how important each of these is. To you, David, let me give you a chance to respond.
Look, the reason why I respectfully disagree with Khaled is that this is not a normal border issue dispute like between Alsace-Lorraine and Europe. Where do you draw the line? The land is part of it. But you've got rejectionist elements like Hamas, which is a huge piece, which was not as dominant 20 years ago when Oslo was started getting to the thing. Why didn't they talk about it then? Because Hamas and Hezbollah, these rejectionist groups, have grown in 20 years. That's why it's become huge. And therefore, it's not just about borders, but it is coming to grips with the other. Israel has no problem to say a Palestinian state for Palestinians, equal rights for all citizens, and without prejudice to final status issues. Those terms can be used so this would not be a backdoor way not to deal with the refugee issue. If you want to solve this, you can solve this. The point is, you got to have the will to solve it, and you've got to come to grip with each other's fears. I think that, frankly, there's a way that Israel has to understand the Palestinian fears about the land. And just as Israel has to understand the Palestinian fears, I think it's not fair to Khaled to say we don't have to understand the Israeli fears because it negates our history. Come on, we're never going to solve the past. We're talking about going forward, about trying to find a way that accepts each other's character. And almost every Arab state writes, you know, in their own constitution about their character as well. But this is an unusual sort of conflict with these rejectionist elements. It's not just about where do you draw a line.
And let me just jump in here, and I know you want to respond, Khaled, but, and I also have some callers I want to get in on the conversation. That's David Makovsky, fellow and director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute. Khaled El-Ghindi is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy. We are talking about what looks like an upcoming vote in the United Nations on the status of Palestinians. And Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, wants to go to the UN this week to seek statehood for the Palestinian people. And we are talking about what can be done to jumpstart some of these negotiations and deal with some of these difficult issues moving forward. What do you think should be done to move forward and get some progress on some of these important but seemingly intractable issues? 1-888-477-9499. Let me get some callers in, and then we'll certainly pick up on some of the things that both of you have said. We have Steve from Willow Grove. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. I appreciate the opportunity to give this question, but
sure. Why
should Obama continue to support Netanyahu's administration when Netanyahu's administration has sabotaged every peace negotiation that has happened since he's been in power? This is documented by WikiLeaks. I need to answer the question off the air, please. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And David Makovsky, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that. Is he right?
I mean, the WikiLeaks that I understand came out in 2009. That's when Netanyahu actually came to power. So I'm not sure I see WikiLeaks as the trump card on this. Look, I don't think there's a mystery here that there's been some tension in the relationship. It's clear. There has also been some areas of a very strong security cooperation. Netanyahu has gone away to praise Obama lately, but I don't think we should hide the fact that there's clearly been some tension. I personally believe that Obama was on the right track in what he spoke about in May, but we wasted 2 years by focusing on other issues. And it's clear that there needs to be, the peace process is very much a part of the U.S.-Israel relationship, and that needs to go forward. So I kind of believe that the Israelis will negotiate on the basis of the Obama speeches, and so I don't see this as a crisis, at the edge, the way the caller suggests.
Khalid El-Ghendi, do you see the United States as the appropriate broker for these negotiations?
Well, the United States certainly has played and probably ought to play a major role. I think what hasn't worked is American exclusive control over this process. And it's just simply the track record is there. I mean, the United States' exclusive domination of this process doesn't work because we all know at the end of the day, the United States, any administration, whether Democratic or Republican, will be constrained by its domestic politics, just like any other government will. The Israeli government has domestic political pressures. And one of the lessons of the Arab Spring is that Arab governments and the Palestinian government in particular also has domestic political constituencies and pressures that need to be accommodated. And one of the primary problems with this process is that it has never taken into account Palestinian domestic political constraints and needs and interests. For example, the Palestinian need for unity is simply logical, I think. In any other context, we understand that a cohesive, unified polity can negotiate on behalf of its people. It has the legitimacy and the mandate to do that. But a divided one does not. And yet, the United States and Israel and essentially the international community has endorsed this approach, has made Palestinian division a precondition towards moving on the peace process. That's no longer viable in this age of the Arab Spring. It's simply one of the things that has to change, and the administration has shown no sign that it's prepared to accept that new reality in the region. And anything that the United States offers is simply going back to the status quo ante. And I just one point. I would agree with David that this is not about statehood and that narratives do matter. And part of the Palestinian narrative is not just Palestinians aren't exclusively focused on the nature of their state. There is a narrative about the refugees also that has been completely ignored in the peace process, largely because the Palestinian leadership has, to a great extent, abandoned the issue. But it's very important, if this Palestinian leadership is to have legitimacy, that it also has to represent the refugees and represent their interests. And that means that the issue has to be on the table.
And that's Khalid El-Ghendi from the Brookings Institution. Also with us is David Makovsky of the Washington Institute. And we are talking about Palestinians, Israelis, United Nations, and the United States. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Looking for solutions to the Arab-Israeli crisis conflict. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, presenting 10 Cents a Dance, a new musical, with performances now through October 9th. Director John Doyle of Broadway's Sweeney Todd brings his touch to the Rodgers and Hart songbook with a cast that doubles as the orchestra, featuring Malcolm Getz and Donna McKechnie. Ticket information to MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey at 609-258-2787 or at macarthur.org.
On the next Fresh Air, where the idea for the show Breaking Bad came from. We'll talk to Vince Gilligan. He's the show's executive producer. And we'll also hear from Aaron Paul, whose character has evolved into one tough drug dealer. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. On the next Voices in the Family, the story of a young Iraqi woman whose life was threatened by extremists for working as a translator with the American forces.
There were bullets in the letters, and they were in my name and my brother's name and my cousin's.
A veteran who refused to forget her.
One of our teammates wasn't coming home, and that was Alia.
And a dedicated lawyer who brought her to this country.
I would email her and say, Alia, don't give up.
That's Voices in the Family, today at noon here on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David Makovsky, fellow and director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute. His most recent work includes an interactive map project called Imagining the Border, Options for Resolving the Israeli-Palestinian Territorial Issue. Also co-author with Dennis Ross of a book that came out in 2009 called Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. Khaled El-Gindi is a visiting fellow with the Brookings Institution Saban Center for Middle East Policy, joining us from their studios. He served with the Negotiation Support Unit in Ramallah as an advisor and also was a key participant in negotiations at Annapolis a couple of years ago. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Ayal from Rydell to join us. Ayal, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for taking my call. No, I appreciate it.
No problem.
So isn't this all about the right of return, guys? To me, it seems like the issue is that the UNRWA has a special definition of what a refugee is, where it gives that refugee status to the descendants of the original Palestinian refugees, which means that if a right of return was granted to any Palestinian refugee, the majority of Israel would then become Palestinian. And it would totally go against the idea that there is a two-state solution when the majority of both populations would be Palestinians. Can you guys please talk about why there is such a special definition for what a Palestinian refugee is? I really appreciate it.
No problem, Ayal. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And, Khaled, can I get a response from you?
Well, historically, the UN agency that the caller referred to, the UNRWA, also known as UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, has been, their mandate is focused exclusively on the refugees of Palestine created, the refugee problem that was created after 1947 until 1949. There's a historical context to why there is a separate agency for that. But sort of skipping over all of that, I'm not sure that's entirely relevant, because at the end of the day, the refugees are an issue that is on the table, has to be on the table for any end of claims, for an end of conflict. But also, there are ways, I think, and the Palestinian leadership has talked about this, the Arab League, I think, also has a similar view. There are ways where there could be a recognition of Palestinian refugee rights, and then the implementation of those rights could happen in a way that does not necessarily lead to 5 million refugees coming into Israel, if even there were that many Palestinian refugees who wanted to go back to their homes. I think the key to the issue of the refugees is, one, recognition, and two, choice. They have to have choices. One of those choices may be to return to their homes in Israel. Other choices will be to return to a Palestinian state. There needs to be a menu of options available to refugees. It can't be the way I think a lot of people in Washington and in Israel talk about the issue. It's simply taken off the table from the get-go. There can be a resolution to the refugee issue that is compatible with the two-state solution and that still respects the injustice that was done to the refugees and acknowledges their rights.
David, looking ahead and even looking at what you have done with some of your mapping, would you say that the future is going to look something like this, assuming there can be some kind of agreement? Two states with sort of 1967 borders, mutually agreed swaps, land for peace, a recognition of Israel as a state, and addressing some of what Khaled El-Gindi was talking about this right of return. Would you say, roughly speaking, that's where people are headed?
I think you had it all right to the left.
The right of return?
I think, yeah, that. I mean, what the caller said, he nailed it. I mean, in many ways. Look, let's be clear, because when people hear the word refugees, they assume that means, what, you're not going to deal with refugees, you want people to live in squalor? God forbid a single person should live in squalor. Part of this whole idea of a two-state solution, of creating a state of Palestine, is that any refugee who would want to go and return to that state would have that right, just as any Jew who wanted to live in the state of Israel would have that right. And I partially agree with Khaled that there would be a menu of options. A person could be compensated, a person who could maybe stay where he is, a person go to a third country, a person could go to Palestine. All those are possible, but if you listen to someone like a leading intellectual, the Palestinian, Sari Nusseibeh, he said Israel would have to be suicidal to agree to have an open right of Palestinians to return to Israel. Then there's no Israel. And I think it's a little too cute to say, well, first they should have an open check right, and then the implementation of that right could be circumscribed. I don't think that's really going to happen, given the lack of trust between these people. Either we're serious about building a two-state solution or we're not. If we are, then we should build it. And that means the refugee issue should be seen in that context. Any refugee who wants to go live in Palestine should have that right to do so, and those other options I mentioned. But if you want to do it the way Khaled said it, then we're all wasting our time here, because then there's no two-state solution. And this thing has to be dealt with in a way that strengthens the two-state solution and not tears it down.
Let me get another caller in. It looks like we have Mitchell from the Northeast joining us on Radio Times. Mitchell, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think the solution to the problem of peace in the Middle East and Israel and Palestine lies in the demonstrations that are currently taking place throughout Israel, which are hundreds of thousands of Arabs, Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews, collaborating and discussing politics, and speakers addressing the economic crisis in Israel for both of them are taking place in Hebrew and in Arabic for the first time in history. I support the right of Palestinian people. I spent a year in Israel as a student, and I think that this idea that there can ever be a two-state solution is a farce. The only solution will be a democratic secular state in which Arabs and Jews and everyone else has equal rights. And I think to the degree that the Palestinians fight for that alongside the allies they are currently winning among working-class Israeli Jews is the degree to which a solution will be forged. And finally, the last point I think that's important is that it will always have to be, and the Palestinians should fight for the idea that that Jews who are persecuted, anti-Semitism that takes place will always have a place to come to there. And to the degree that they can collaborate on that, as they are currently beginning to for the first time in history, I think that will be the solution. It can't be a two-state solution, because all that means is the oppression of the Palestinians.
Well, Mitchell, let me see first what David...
I'll take my response off the air.
I appreciate
you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. David Makovsky, I'm curious about your response.
I'm sorry to say this, but I try to be respectful. What he just said is sheer fantasy. It'll never happen. There's too much traumas between Israelis and Palestinians, whether the issue is occupation, whether the issue is terrorism. They don't speak physically the same language. When they abolish ethnic states in India and Pakistan, the caller should get back to me. In terms of the demonstrations about economics, it's a nice thing, and I also hope it's succeeding. It's about a squeezed middle class that feels that they can't make a go of it in terms of the standard of living, in terms of taxation, in terms of housing prices. And these are issues that have to be addressed, and it's often the middle class in Israel that feels much of the burden is on their shoulders, because some of the others in Israel don't share in that burden, whether it's the ultra-Orthodox or others. And so, that's a fascinating sociological development. It might have political implications. I don't think it's the way the caller, though, expressed it.
Well, and Khaled, let me put a question to you about the Arab Spring, as it has been called over the last 6 months, where people in Arab countries in the Middle East and North Africa essentially rising up against their government. Does Mahmoud Abbas fear an Arab Spring within the West Bank?
I think he does, and I think also the Hamas leadership in Gaza also fears a similar type of uprising directed at their rule of the Gaza Strip. I think any Arab leader who sits in power who isn't concerned about this wave of discontent of the masses is delusional, and I think it's very much on his mind. It's not the root cause of why he's going to the UN, but it's certainly, I think, given it a lot more urgency. It's constrained his ability to return to a status quo ante type of quote unquote peace process, because if he were, I'll just give you an example.
Okay.
If Mahmoud Abbas were to do exactly what David is asking for now, and that is return to the peace talks, abandon the bid at the UN and return to negotiations with Netanyahu at the same time that he's expanding settlements in the West Bank and in Jerusalem and the siege of Gaza continues, I can assure you that Abu Mazen would not remain in power for much longer if he were to simply go back to that situation. And so a lot of this really is not by choice. He simply cannot afford to go back to the failed status quo, because there will be, I think, a popular popular anger will be directly directed at him. And so this at least buys him the ability to this buys him some time to deflect what is a lot of popular anger at the past failures.
I want to actually play just a quick response, David. I hear you. Sounds like you want to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just again say, I want to, respectfully, I would just like to say that I did not just say return to the status quo. I mentioned President Obama's speeches. And by the way, this is not just an American idea or an Israeli idea. I mean, this the Europeans have also come together and say the way to solve this problem is through returning to the table. Again, I think by having these speeches as terms of reference, as a framework, this will give some shape to the talks and make sure they do not meander. So I just don't want to be misrepresented as if to say, well, I'll just go back and talking for talking. No, I think we got to, if we're serious people, we want a two-state solution, we've got to try to shape these talks so they have the optimal chance of success. But without talking, we will not get to a solution. So we need the direction, and we need the negotiations themselves.
Let me play actually a just one sentence from a speech that President Obama gave almost a year ago at the UN General Assembly. Let's listen.
When we come back here next year, we can have an agreement that will lead to a new member of the United Nations, an independent, sovereign state of Palestine, living in peace with Israel.
I wonder to you, Khaled, about, how many times have we heard that spoken by other presidents, other negotiators, and how much do you think the kind of frustration of the inability to resolve some of these issues is feeding the situation today?
I think that's exactly right. Obama has said it, and I just want to take issue with something David said, that this is the May 19th speech and the terms of reference that were outlined in it is not new. If negotiating a final border between Israel and Palestine on the basis of the 1967 line is a revolutionary new idea, it's the oldest new idea in history because it's at least 10 or 20 years old. Every administration has understood, anyone who's been involved in this process has understood that those are the basic outlines of a two-state solution. The fact that he was able to say articulate it, I don't think makes it terribly new. In fact, it was the absolute minimum that he would say, and he didn't go, I think, as far as Palestinians would have wanted him to. But again, this is Mahmoud Abbas calling the United States and Israel and the quartet and everyone on their bluff. You all have said you want a two-state solution. I'm proposing a two-state solution, and I'm going to the UN to register a two-state solution, and you all are opposing it. That's essentially what this is about. American opposition is about process because they're not controlling it. That's why they have resorted to essentially playing the role of a spoiler. Instead of embracing this as an opportunity to save the two-state solution, they're fighting it, and ultimately, I think, to their own detriment.
Well, do you, and we're almost out of time here, David, but do you see the United States as essentially caught between Israelis and Palestinians on this issue?
It saddens me that Khaled is accusing the U.S. of bad faith here on this. I mean, I do not think this is about bluffing at all. I think this is about trying to find terms of reference where the parties can sit and solve their problems. I think they are concerned about some of these red lines that Israel has put forward. They see this as real. I don't think it's all just about politics. I think the real work is to get back to the table, and that requires both sides to cross historic threshold. Yes, Israel does, but also Khaled should acknowledge that there are things that the Palestinians need to do as well and cross historic thresholds as well, and not to say, well, if the U.S. would twist harder, everything would be better. Each side has some reckoning to do here, and it's not just right to dump the onus on the United States and Israel. I think that's very an unfair portrayal.
But who puts pressure on the sides to get back to the table? Very briefly, David, and then from you, Khaled, we've got
I think it's the quartet. It's the U.S., the European Union, the Russia, the U.N., and say, here, these are the terms of reference. And then that would make a huge difference. But Khaled, I think he just, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm very saddened by it, but I think it's an unfair portrayal to put all the onus on the United States and Israel. I just think it's very unfair.
Go ahead, Khaled. We're almost out of time, but I want to give you a chance to respond.
Well, I'm not putting the onus entirely on the United States and Israel. What I'm trying to do is read Mahmoud Abbas's mind. And what he's saying is, you guys have promised to support a two-state solution. You did certain things that actually made a two-state solution harder on the ground. You've contributed to the weakening of my government with the abandonment of the settlement freeze, with the insistence that the Palestinians not be unified, that they continue to be divided, with not putting any pressure on Israel and only putting pressure on the Palestinians. And so what Mahmoud Abbas is saying is, if you can't find a different way to manage this process, I will go elsewhere.
Well, I wish we could continue our conversation. Such an important issue, but I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Khaled Al-Gindi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And David Makovsky, thank you very much as well.
Delighted to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. And I realize what a serious and important issue this is, and how impossible it is to shoehorn everything into an hour. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls as well.